Intro to Digital Archaeology.
Intro to Digital Archaeology.
Intro to Digital Archaeology.
HIST 3000.
At Carleton University.
With Professor Sean Graham.
So last week, I went to a graveyard not too far from my house. It took me about 15 minutes to walk there, crossing roads with heavy traffic. It's in the corner of a city park, underneath a bunch of old maple trees. The ground outside the little graveyard's precinct is lumpy and uneven, and as I look into the underbrush, I'm pretty certain that I'm seeing the foundation pit of a small structure. As I recorded the graves into our digital recording form, I got pretty frustrated. The shape and designs of the stones almost match the example types from the Discovering England's Burial Spaces recording scheme, but not quite. And so I have to make some decisions here. Is it more like this type, or is it more like that type? And I'm aware that as I make these decisions, I am creating a record. And that the record is not the thing itself, but as it becomes a data point, it takes on a different kind of materiality altogether. The work of recording these stones, it's not fast, it's not efficient. I make mistakes. I must have sat on the grass staring at the stone and flipping through my printout of the different types, about 30 minutes, just for the one stone. I wanted to get it right. And, you know, when you think about it, this act of recording the stone is a bit like close reading. It forces me to pay attention to the material of the stone, the shape of its decorations, the motifs used, the verses inscribed, the names and relationships of the dead. One of the stones in this graveyard is for a small child who passed away at 4 years of age. There are no details given, but it makes me think of my own children. And I look at another stone and note the same date of death and realize that here is the mother. And I wonder at what calamity took them both. It's quite emotional, really. I have no hesitation to tell you that. This week, you're continuing to record your stones. It does take a lot of time, and to do it well forces you to think about this interplay between the act of recording and the close reading of the material. You think about what is lost and what is gained by this act of recording. And I wonder to myself, how do I record the effective aspect of doing this work? You know, that emotional response to discovering the mother and the child. And surely that's part of what a memorial to the departed is meant to achieve. To make you feel something. So what does our recording system miss? This week, I want you to reflect on the ways the coding scheme we used for recording the graveyards failed. Then I want you to take that scheme, modify it in the light of this reflection on what failed, modify it so that it's better. Does the job cleaner, more effectively, more efficiently, captures a wider variety of data, gets at the experience better. You need to decide what the issue is and then see if you can re-implement it to address that issue. Now, you don't have to then go out and re-record everything you've already recorded in the graveyard, though you're welcome to do that if you've got the time and energy. But rather, what I want you to see is how your choices intersect with the decisions already taken by the Kobo Toolbox people to conspire to make your graveyard data observable. Other tasks this week can include getting to know a bit about the statistical software R and a bit of futzing about with databases. So thinking about data models and data design, and then looking at some of the ways we record and keep that data handy, but also some of the ways we then manipulate it. If you also have time, I want you to take photographs and videos of stones, which we will use eventually for the creation of 3D models. And this too is a kind of close contemplation of a stone because it takes care and effort to capture photos that can be stitched together into a model. When the light falls across the stones at an oblique angle, it can sometimes be easier to read the inscriptions. In a 3D model, when you digitally remove the surface texture, you can sometimes see the inscriptions in the model surface. For me, these models have aura because they are imbued with the work, care, and attention that went into reading and recording the stones in the first place. Years ago, Walter Benjamin, in a piece called The Work of Art in the Age of Mechanical Reproduction, argued that a reproduction has no aura, no authenticity, that aura was connected to the uniqueness of a thing. A reproduction has no authority to speak about the thing reproduced. But I have my doubts. These 3D models that I make, they've got aura, but it might not be the kind of aura that we're used to thinking about. So this week, you continue to put materials into a database and you create digital representations of these materials. Think about what is created by these acts of digitization. Think about the emotional connection you may or may not have with the material and how that might be recorded. And think about how you've come to know this material. This is the day-to-day work of digital archaeology, of creating these moments from the material we find. This week, we're joined by Bill Carraher. And as you listen to Bill's response to the questions I've asked him, I want you to think about what he has to say about ethics and workflow and aura and the questions that digital archaeology raises. Think about his own process and his own relationship with the digital and his ideas about focusing on the day-to-day work of doing digital archaeology.
Hello, Sean's digital archaeology class. My name is Bill Carraher, and this is like the seventh time I've started this recording. Sean sent us a series of questions, and I think I'm just going to go through them point by one at a time and give you kind of a sense for who I am, what I'm working on, and how I think about digital archaeology. I'm an associate professor at the University of North Dakota. I'm in a history department, and I'll give you a little background to why that is. I currently work on a few projects, including I'm mired in preparing a preliminary report for my field work in Greece as part of the Western Argolid Regional Project, or WARP, which we'll come back to, I think. I'm working on a final publication for some excavations, one in eastern Cyprus at a site that I directed excavations at called the Pila Koutsopetria Archaeological Project, and the other is in western Cyprus at a place called Polis Tis Chrysokou, which is part of the Princeton Cyprus expedition, and it's documenting a project that is 20 years of excavation there that were concluded largely in the late 20th century. So it's kind of a legacy project. I'm also writing a small book on the archaeology of the contemporary American experience, and this is based on some of my work in the Bakken oil patch, where I did a kind of archaeology of workforce housing in the 21st century, and work with Andrew Reinhart, who I suspect will give one of these little audio recordings, at the famous ET excavations, Atari excavations in Alamogordo, New Mexico. I'm also the publisher and director at the Digital Press at the University of North Dakota. I've had the privilege of publishing some of Professor Graham's work, including his Failing Gloriously. And I'm also the editor of a literary journal called North Dakota Quarterly, which publishes, despite its name, twice a year. So I do a bunch of things on the side. How did I get started in digital archaeology? Well, I came to archaeology quite late in my graduate school career. I actually was trained primarily as a text person, as a historian, all the way through my master's degree. In the US, master's degrees tend to be 2 years. So even after my master's degree, I had anticipated that I would do a dissertation that involved text. It was really a historical type thing. However, after my MA, I did a season of field work with an excavation affiliated with my university. And I did it mostly as an excuse to get to Greece and just to see what was going on. And this was at a place called Ismia, which is a Panhellenic sanctuary in the Peloponnesus of Greece. And it was with my advisor, Tim Gregory. After doing a season of that, I became kind of interested in not only the field work component, being in Greece, and that all was great, but also some of the data management issues. I'm kind of a weird guy in that I'm almost 50, but I can't remember ever living in a house without a computer. Both my parents were computer people, and my life has always been mediated in some way digitally or surrounded by digital tools. I'm not much of a programmer or a coder. My mother was a coder, high-level coding for bioinformatics and artificial intelligence. But I'm more like my dad, who's really an information technology guy who thought in terms of digital workflows. In fact, my father has patents on digital notebooks for research, which he did while working for DuPont. So these are for corporate kind of research. So early on, I began to think a lot about how computers could do things for us and with us. So when I started doing some archaeological field work, and again, this was mostly just on a lark, I took pretty quickly with working on the digital tools, particularly the off-the-shelf digital tools, things like Microsoft Access or ArcGIS, and even adapting quickly to various specialized pieces of software, like the software that comes with a Trimble GPS unit or something, or Agisoft Metashape more recently. So I think I understand fairly well, primarily because of my upbringing, how digital technology works. In other words, I'm not super savvy with creating programs of my own. I've never done any agent-based modeling. I'm not creating fancy 3D models. I'm not creating immersive virtual and artificial or augmented reality worlds. I don't really do that stuff. But I think a lot in terms of how digital tools can be integrated into archaeological workflow. It also so happens that I'm not a very good digital dirt archaeologist. And because I'm not very good doing dirt archaeology, I'm not a very good excavator, and I'm fine at survey, although survey archaeology mostly involves walking around and being able to recognize pottery on the ground, right? This is not like higher level archaeology in most ways. It was very easy for me to get involved in archaeology by saying, hey, I'll do digital grunt work. And also, as I said, sort of integrated with what I know. As the projects I worked on initially as a graduate student began to wind down, particularly the Eastern Carinthia Archaeological Survey, which was a survey affiliated in some ways with the excavations at Isthmia, I began to play more and more with both GIS and databases and using them not just to document what was going on in the field, but how to analyze the results of that. And when I started some of my own projects, I began to develop more specialized understandings of these tools as parts of the archaeological toolkit. This gave me an opportunity to start a project of my own because I was seen really as the digital guy. I prepared the databases, I managed digital workflow, I prepared the GIS, I made sure things coming out of our Trimble differential GPS, coming off the field and iPads, coming in through our ceramic analysis, typing them into his laptop, all could be folded together and integrated in a meaningful way. And I've also retained some of that kind of position on the projects as we've moved toward publishing that data. In other words, we've published now the data from Pila Koutsopetria, which is a project of mine on Cyprus that started in 2003, at Open Context, which is Eric Kanza and Sarah Kanza's Alexandria Archive Initiative digital publishing platform for data. So I've been able to see that data from creation all the way through to publication. And we're beginning to work to do the same thing with the Western Argolid data. So that's kind of my interest and my background. So what is the biggest challenge facing digital archaeology at the moment? At first, I wanted to say whatever center digital archaeology once existed, whatever the center of that was, kind of has dissipated. Like, I don't really think any longer in terms of digital archaeology. I think there's just too much going on under that umbrella. It ranges from, again, virtual reality, augmented reality, things like that, incredibly nuanced technologies used to create digital reconstructions, agent-based modeling, what Sean is doing, high-level statistics stuff, all the way to the very, very mundane sort of trench-side stuff that I work on. And that's all kind of under the same umbrella. And that, to me, kind of begs us to reconsider how we think of digital archaeology and maybe shifting from understanding it as digital archaeology singular to digital archaeologies, digital archaeologies plural. But in some ways, I'm not sure that's a challenge. Like, I think that's already naturally happening. When I gravitate toward archaeologists doing digital things, I most often go and hang out with the people working on legacy data. I very rarely go and hang out with the agent-based modelers, although I like Sean, or the people doing high-powered 3D reconstructions of things. That's just not my jam. I don't understand the technology behind it, and I don't really have that as part of my toolkit. So really, maybe all I'm talking about is a slight change in how we refer to digital archaeology as opposed to something that's an actual challenge to what it means. Then I started thinking a little bit about my own efforts to think about digital archaeology. I've written a couple articles that have developed this idea of slow archaeology, and really what my interest is the way in which digital tools shape what we do in the field. And really the sort of workflow that connects how we collect information in the field, convert it to data, analyze it, and that means integrating with other data sets, that means cleaning it up, that means making sure that the data itself makes sense, and then how we interpret it in the end, and ultimately how we publish it. As a publisher, I've been able to see some of this data from the point of creation in the field all the way through to the point of formal publication, either on something like Open Context as data or as sort of integrated into an archaeological monograph that my press maybe had a role in publishing. So I've been able to see this kind of trajectory, and I want to understand that workflow better. But I think that's kind of chasing my own tail. I think I'm the one talking about that, and I often worry that there's really no one else in the room. It's just kind of echoing around. So I guess I've kind of come around to thinking that the biggest challenge involves thinking not only about digital workflows, but thinking broadly about the role in which digital practices are asking us to consider the ethical frameworks in which we function as archaeologists. That my great fear and my great it comes from seeing people using tools uncritically, and the way in which these digital, in other words, I want us to be able to critique better the way in which digital tools and digital practice, for example, reproduce hierarchy within the discipline. I want to understand how digital recording practices challenge ideas of heritage, ownership, and stewardship in our field, right? If we continue to talk about things like the Parthenon marbles being returned to Greece, right? But once everyone has high density 3D scans of these models, and these can swap around the internet, that you can download them from a WeTransfer site or whatever, what is the meaning of the actual object if it's already been reproduced, if every casino in Vegas could have a copy of it? And how do we connect ownership with the proliferation of digital copies, or the ability for digital copies of not only objects but data to kind of move seamlessly around the world? How do digital practices reinforce colonial relationships? What are our responsibilities toward digital ephemera? Like, are we supposed to save every email? Well, I tend to, just because I don't delete stuff from my inbox. But how do we regard that with in relation to things that we know we need to archive, right? Like, if we collect data in the field, these are special shiny data that we archive and we publish sometimes, versus the emails that frame that data, or our discussions of how we came to defining our data as such. How does that get saved? How does that stuff, where does that stuff fit in? What are the ethics of open access in practice? You know, I'm sure you guys are going to talk about open tools and open access, and this tends to be seen in a very utopian light, but open access also isn't universal. That many places see, that certain places in the world rather, see open access as another way in which a certain kind of elite European, North American standards are being forced on parts of the world that have very different ideas about intellectual property. How do we understand critically the relationship between private profit and public good in the digital tools we use? I'm recording this on a microphone that says Blue. It's a Blue Snowball mic that's plugged into my MacBook Pro. That all of these things, you know, the way we talk about a computer now involves the brand of the computer, right? We live in this branded world that has ethical implications. What are the ethics of our desire to become more efficient? And the way in which that efficiency is pushed back through digital workflows, and the way in which the corporate world is attempting to leverage that efficiency to create markets for their new technologies. What are the ethics involved in selecting the material technologies that we use in our discipline? When I use my MacBook Pro or I use my iPhone, that these things are great technologies that can do amazing things, but they also represent the labor of thousands and thousands of people, many of whom, as Sean points out in his most recent book, don't have the same advantages we have, that many of the people who are mining for rare earth or whatever are never going to own an iPhone, right? So this is these things really do have incredibly significant. If we say that we think about material culture critically, then we must also think about the tools that we use critically, the materialness of them inherently. And on and on and on. How do we understand asymmetries in funding associated with digital innovation? How do we frame ethically the very concept of innovation? Do we want to be innovators all the time? Do we have to be innovators? So this kind of ethical universe that I've babbled on to you about now for 4 or 5 minutes, all are things that I think have to move to the center of digital archaeology. And I think because digital tools are ubiquitous now, I think it will drag the entire disciplinary center, the ethical conversation in archaeology more broadly, into this area. This isn't to say there aren't other valuable ethical conversations worth having, but I think that the tools we use being problematized in this way are forcing us to think differently. And so I'll come back to that in just a minute. So what drives me up the wall about how digital archaeology is currently perceived or received in the professions? This is Sean's fourth question. I don't really get easily perturbed by how others see my work. I'm not maybe the most brilliant dude. I'm not the most, you know, I'm not a rocket surgeon or anything. So if I worried too much about what people thought of my stuff, I probably would never write anything down. I fail ingloriously in most cases. I fail in just ordinary ways, not in the spectacular ways that Sean has encouraged us all to fail. But I think that I tend to get annoyed most by the lack of interest in really ordinary work, particularly the small scale and iterative adaptive practices that make technology work for an archaeologist on a day-to-day level. I think that there's still an attraction to disruption. There's an attraction to innovation. There's constant support being given to projects that, frankly, from my perspective, often just reinvent the wheel. Like if we need another online data management platform for archaeologists, I think that's the last thing we need. Although I bet you every round of NSF and NEH, these are the two big American, federal agencies in the United States that provide money for archaeology research, the equivalent of SHRC in Canada. I'm sure every year at least one of those kinds of projects get funded. On the flip side, there are a lot of people doing really, really good work with off-the-shelf kit that is both off-the-shelf technology, your iPhone, your iPad, but also off-the-shelf data management tools, whether it's Access or FileMaker Pro, or even lowly Excel or Google Sheets and things like that. They're making these tools work. They're adapting them. They're tweaking them. They're making them work within an archaeological context. And I think that if we don't talk enough about that, if we don't highlight that, our concept of digital archaeology becomes grounded in this kind of fetishization of innovation, right? This kind of, and this to me is the height of a kind of macho capitalism, a kind of go big or go home, where the real titans of industry are the innovators or the disruptors, right? They're the Elon Musks, they're the Steve Jobs, they're the Bill Gates and people like that. But frankly, and Sean is one of my inspirations for this, they often stand on the top of a huge pyramid of people who are just doing everyday work, right? Everyday work to make make the innovations that these individuals make their billions and maybe even trillions very soon off of reality. And what I'd like to see us do in archaeology is celebrate a little bit less the grand slams and play a little bit more small ball, to use a baseball metaphor, to celebrate a little more the small ball, the guys who get on base, the guys who take a lot of walks, the guys who adapt the technology to use it in a specific case and do it in an interesting way that is adaptable, that is shareable, that is capable of being used in a lot of different contexts. Finally, what fills me with hope about the field? I often feel like digital archaeology forces us to pay attention to the day-to-day practices that non-digital versions of archaeology, and this goes for the humanities and the relationship to digital humanities, history and its relationship to digital history. In other words, digital archaeology forces us to think about day-to-day practices that we tend to approach as settled. In other words, but digital archaeology is forcing us to think about some things that for the last 50 or 70 years haven't really been thought about very much. Something as simple as writing in a notebook, something as simple as illustrating an object or a section of a trench. These are things that have been done in largely similar ways, or at very least with little sustained conversation, a critical conversation for probably 50 or 80 years. Suddenly digital archaeology has forced us to think about these things in new ways. In other words, it's forced us to say, what is it that we do when we record a trench section by hand, when we draw it? What do we do when we write in a notebook? These very, very basic things are suddenly being brought into attention, we're suddenly bringing more attention to them because we're attempting to digitize these longstanding analog practices. In fact, the emergence of digital archaeology has created the kind of notion of analog archaeology, right? That are fast practices, let's say, in digital archaeology. And here again, I'm thinking of my specialty, which is really field recording, not necessarily computational stuff. But our desire for efficiency has cast light on older practices, which are inefficient but also distinct in their own right. So what fills me with hope is that by shifting our attention to the day-to-day work of archaeology, rather than these higher order theorizing, rather than these higher order interpretive questions, whether if the higher order narratives that tend to dominate our archaeological publications, that by bringing light back down onto more specific stuff, digital archaeology is enriching how we think about archaeology on a day-to-day level. And I think this has real potential not only to have us consider critically the ethical underpinning of archaeology, again, going back to the issue of ethics and how it is that we produce knowledge, what are the social and political and economic relationships that lead to the production of archaeological knowledge, but also just simply critical attention to the way in which our epistemologies and our ontologies, that's how we know and what we know, are put into practice. And I think that's something that digital archaeology is sort of nudging us at ever-increasing pace to sort of think about and consider. Okay, I've gone on for way, way too long, well in excess of the 5 minutes that Sean has asked me, asked me to comment. Thanks for your attention, and good luck with the semester. And thanks, Sean, for inviting me to talk to your class.